supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a questions of the week. Yeah, we're doing a double header in honor of baseball season. We're going to talk about the slimy slugs that are devouring young plants at this time of year and why there is only one good place for your grass clippings. But before that, lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carolyn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Carolyn fine?
Seminole, Oklahoma.
Which is just to the east of Oklahoma City, right?
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Carolyn in Oklahoma?
All right. I've had rose bushes in my yard for years, and I've never had any problems. But this year, my roses didn't come back. And so when I got to checking, something has eaten the roots off of all my rose bushes. Can you tell me what this might be and what I can do to prevent it if I put more roses back out there?
That is highly unusual. The creature most responsible for eating the roots of plants in my region, the Mid-Atlantic states, the Northeast, would be the vole, V-O-L-E. They are small, mouse-like, shrewish-like creatures, and they breed prodigiously, and they don't really live underground. They live like almost in between, a little underground and on the surface, but they do go underground to eat, and they eat spring bulbs and the roots of plants, famously hostas.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a lot of heavy mulch around your roses?
No, I don't. It's just, actually, they've been in about 15 years. I've never had any problem.
Okay.
Until this year.
Do you perhaps have gophers in the area?
Now, there might be, but I haven't seen any, but I've seen evidence of them in the yard or two down the road.
Oh, okay. This is a topic we don't often talk about on the show because, as you know, gophers are a very localized problem. But for the people who have them, they are a serious problem. Most garden specialists consider gophers to be the most tenacious underground pests. They do a lot of damage, and they are very clever. I mean, people talk about Caddyshack, the movie with Bill Murray. That was a gopher that caused him to blow up the golf course. So I wouldn't say there's any easy ways to deter them, but ways that are similar to the ways that we would use to deter voles in the East is when you're planting your new rose bushes to actually dig the hole and then line the inside of the hole with a material called hardware cloth. Are you familiar with that?
No, but I can find out what it is.
Oh, yeah, you can find it at any hardware store or home center. It's like window screening, but it's a much heavier metal with much larger openings, but not very large at all. And you can get it in all kinds of different sizes. And it's very strong. Creatures can't chew through it. And so you would dig a deeper hole than normal, and you would line the inside with this hardware cloth. And be careful. You need wire cutters, and the edges can be sharp. But if you make a perfect cage in the ground, then you drop a little compost in the bottom, and then you put your rose on top of that and fill it in, then they should not be able to get at the roots of your roses. There's another technique that people use, and sometimes this is even a branded product. I don't know if it's still available, but sharp stones. You dig the hole, you drop the root of the plant, whether it's a rose or something else, into the ground, and then you fill in around it with these sharp stones. And again, I remember years ago there was actually a product sold in garden centers, and I can't for the life of me remember the name, but it was designed to protect spring bulbs and stuff from voles, and it would be equally effective from gophers. And when I say sharp stones, if you make a big pit and it's filled with stones around the roof of the plant, they're not going to be able to get at the roots. So that's that's the easiest way. That's is to physically protect the roots. Just, you know, think about something you can put in there that's still going to allow good drainage and will keep those sharp-teethed creatures away.
Okay. I'll give it a try because my rose was a beautiful, large, salmon-colored climbing rose by my front gate, and I've had it about 15 years, and it's gone.
Well, I'm sorry about that. We have to share this world with a lot of creatures, some of which like to eat our plants. But I think that should help you in the future, Carolyn.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I am just ducky today, Joe. Thank you for asking. How are you, sir?
We're getting along.
And where is Joe getting along?
Right in Philadelphia.
And where in Philadelphia?
In Fishtown, specifically.
Why did I know you were going to say Fishtown? I just, you know, that is the happening section of Philly right now, man.
Yeah, that's what they all tell me.
Yeah. All right. What can we do for Joe in fabulous Fishtown?
All righty. So all the soil in my neighborhood is contaminated from years and years of a lot of galvanizing factories in the neighborhood.
Oh, and lead paint and lead gasoline.
Exactly. All that good stuff. So I rent a home, but it's a long-term rental. And
right.
I was planning on building some raised beds, which I know you're a big fan of, in the backyard.
Right.
Which, and for the neighborhood, I've got a pretty good-sized piece of property to work with. So my question for you is, I was planning on making the raised beds like in the 24-inch, tall enough that you could sit on them as well for, you know, if I have people over, sit on the edge. I was going to make them out of 4x4s.
I don't advise the sitting.
Don't advise the sitting.
No.
Okay. Right.
Now, well, and what I would suggest instead is that you invest in pavers or the pre-made raised bed kits you can get in home stores right now. Because you're out of time, Joe. It's late in the season.
Well, I've already kind of given up. I just moved into the house about a month ago, so I knew I wasn't going to get it this year, but for next year.
Okay. Well, let's say you move fast. You do what I say. When you go to the garden center, you may find that they have, like, full-grown peppers and stuff still going begging. But certainly you can get these ready to grow a mess of salad greens where you are. In the urban section of Philadelphia, you can grow salad greens straight through the winter.
Okay.
You know, as long as there's sun hitting the area.
Right. Well, that's another problem I have. My neighbor has a pretty mature Asian mulberry and a ailanthus, which destroys the sunlight in my backyard.
Well, then what makes you think you're going to get away with anything here?
Well, wing and a prayer, hope for the best. I lean towards shade tolerant plants. I mean, I want to grow some vegetables, but I like flowers and things.
Okay.
More so.
All right. So here's what you do. You go out and you get pavers because then when you move, for instance, you can take the pavers with you and build something new at your new house.
Right.
Or these pre-made 4x4 raised bed kits that are very inexpensive, very well made with nice cedar and corner posts. And then you don't have any work to do. And what you do is you lay cardboard, single sheets of cardboard, over top of your contaminated soil. You put your raised bed frames in place, or you build the 4x4 or 4x8 raised bed out of your pavers. And with the pavers, you can make it any height you want. And then you find a good source of compost and topsoil nearby. And you fill the raised beds with a combination half and half of compost and topsoil. Get yourself a big bag of perlite. I mean, the bags of perlite can be as big as a child.
Right.
And mix one of those into each of your raised bed. And boom, you've got an instant growing area that's not contaminated, that's safe to work in, where the soil is nice and loose, where you can grow anything. And then if and when you move, you should be able to take your frames and your pavers with you to the new place. It's not like you're going to abandon it.
Okay. All right, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to know. Would I have to dig down?
No.
And if so, how deep, whatever?
No, no. That's the thing that people don't understand about contaminated soil. It's not so much the plants are going to take up the toxins and make you sick. It's when you actually disturb the soil and the lead gets into your skin or up into your lungs and stuff like that. And you're very smart because in an urban area like yours, you're right. You don't have to have that soil tested. You know it's toxic.
Yeah.
So you just cover it completely. You don't work in it. You don't disturb in it. But you use it as a base to lay raised bed frames on top and then grow in safe soil. And the cardboard on the bottom will prevent the roots of your plants from getting into the bad soil and just also help prevent weed problems.
Right, right. Okay.
All right.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Joe.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who planted garlic last fall to cut off and eat the scapes, those bulges that appear at the top of the central stalk at each plant. You'll get some very interesting eating and much bigger heads as a result. But don't go taking your big head out to the garden with a pair of scissors just yet, because we'll be right back with slugs, grass clippings, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, not a question of the week, two questions of the week. It's a summertime doubleheader. How to properly use your grass clippings and how to fight off those slimy slugs. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rebecca, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you?
I am just ducky today, Rebecca. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
And where is Rebecca great?
In Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Rebecca in Wilmington?
So earlier this season, I put out a bit of a container garden at one of a space in a community garden somewhere in Wilmington.
Okay.
And I was doing tomatoes, okra, basil, marigolds, and bell peppers. But then I had an unexpected stay in the hospital for 2 weeks, and so they got terribly waterlogged. The drainage holes that I had made weren't big enough. So I'm wondering if that 2 weeks of damage is going to make it so that I can't get any fruit all season. Because, of course, I'm happy to take care of them if I'm going to get some tomatoes and peppers. But if I'm driving all the way down to the garden every day and not getting anything for the whole season, that would make me kind of sad.
Okay.
So I just wanted to know, you know, if you thought that they could be saved or not.
Okay, so what kind of containers did you use?
I used, reused plastic 5-gallon buckets.
Oh, they are the worst. They are plant killers, and they are probably the ugliest planters you can ever use. I would have thrown you out of the garden for coming in with 5-gallon buckets, and they really can't support big tomatoes. I always advise people to go out and buy real containers with real drainage holes. There's just something about 5-gallon buckets, their size, their shape, their consistency. I never see good results with them. And you know, one thing now is we're late in the season. So one good thing about buying containers, real containers at this time of year, is the garden centers really don't have a lot to do at this time of year. They sold most of their plants. A lot of them will actually start closing down during the week, and you will find good sales on really nice containers, things you'll be proud to use. Now, if you want to continue with your 5-gallon buckets, I presume you've emptied them out and re-drilled holes in them and everything?
Yes.
And how did the roots of the plants look?
So once the new drainage holes were in, the soil did drain out, and now they look normal. They're not too soggy or anything like that. My only concern is I know if you let tomato plants dry out too many times, you're not going to get any fruit.
No.
So I didn't know if the reverse was true.
No. That's the first thing isn't true. Tomato plants do like to be watered evenly, and one of the negatives of containers is that it can be really difficult to keep them evenly watered, especially the way it sounds is if you have to drive there. They would probably be doing much better. You have space in a community garden. Why aren't they just planted in the ground?
It's not a plot. It's a space that the organizers are letting me use temporarily.
Oh, okay. It's going to be a difficult situation. You want more drainage than less. And I hope, did you fill the containers at least with a soil-free mix?
It is a container blend with compost, and I don't remember if it's soil-free.
Oh, okay. No, that's fine. A container blend would be good. If the roots of your plants look okay, if they didn't get rotten and slimy, and if the plants are now upright and growing well, you may have dodged a bullet. You know, sometimes we get really rainy weather for a long time in the spring, and even plants in good soil in the ground get waterlogged. So as long as they are recovering, as long as the leaves are green and not yellow, as long as the roots were not slimy, you should be okay. But I would also advise you to visit some local garden centers. See if you can get some great deals on containers that are already much better draining and much better shaped and sized. And consider that for next year at least.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for your help.
All right. Good luck, Rebecca.
All right. Take care.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, John. How are you, man?
I'm fine, and I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
Excellent. Always wonderful to hear from our friends in the Nashville and Memphis area. What can we do for John in Nashville?
Well, last year I decided to try some giant hyacinth bulbs, and I put them in some containers I have, large containers. I planted them in the wintertime and kept them in the garage until spring. They sprouted. I moved them outdoors, and they came up, and they were just gorgeous. I would like to use the containers for annuals this summer. What should I do to the hyacinth bulbs to reuse them again next fall?
Well, it sounds like you did a really good job. So you don't have a lot of or any in-ground space, so you actually forced these bulbs the way professionals do.
Well, they bloomed at their proper time in the late spring. You know, and they were outside most of their lives. I only kept them indoors through January and February, just, you know, the coldest time of the year. Other than that, they were outdoors in a southern exposure-protected place. And they didn't, you know, we didn't have any really bad freezes last winter. So they survived fine, and they grew. And
No, you misunderstand me, John. They need a chilling period. Spring bulbs like hyacinths, tulips, daffodils, they need to go through a winter chill. And for instance, if your containers are big enough and they're made of the right material, you can even just leave them out over winter. But moving them into a garage where it got really cold for that time was the right thing to do. I will tell you in the future to make sure you expose them to 12 or 16 weeks of cold. You know, don't keep them in a warm spot over the winter. Okay, so
it stays in the low 40s, upper 30s in the garage.
That's perfect.
But it never freezes in there.
That's perfect. So, but you're looking at 12 to 16 weeks of that to make sure you get.
Well, I planted them in, I think it was about the first week of November, and then didn't bring them outdoors until March.
Okay, that sounds good. Now, after they were done blooming, did you let the greenery survive?
The greenery has totally died back. It's gone. I've kept them dry, the soil dry. When it's rained, I have covered them over and have not watered them myself. The soil is damp to the field. It's not hard pan dried out. But
okay,
How should I handle them? Do they need any curing in the sun, for instance?
Oh goodness, no. Nothing needs curing in the sun except people with vitamin D deficiencies. No. What you do, since you did wisely let the greenery die down naturally, which meant that you recharge the bulbs with solar energy. So inside those bulbs right now should be next year's flowers. If you were to take a knife and cut open one of those bulbs, inside the onion-like layers inside, you should actually see the flower that is laying there dormant until next spring. So, and it's very important to let the greenery die down naturally, which you've done. So what you want to do is you want to go into your containers and very carefully dig around in there. Don't use anything sharp and spear the bulbs or anything like that. Bring the bulbs up out of the containers. And then, curing them, quote unquote, is not the world's worst idea. But what I would do is leave them inside on some newspaper under a ceiling fan for a day or two. And just turn them over once or twice. And then you get like a cardboard box or something like that, and you fill it with peat moss, and you put the bulbs inside the peat moss in the cardboard box. And then you put that someplace that can be hot, and you can mist the peat moss a little bit, but not much. They want to be warm and dry over the summertime. And then, yes, in your area, November is the ideal time to replant them for springtime bloom.
Well, just as a little sidelight, I have a great collection of caladiums that I've collected over the years, and I do bring those bulbs up out of the ground every October and
right.
Don't let them freeze. Now, what the folks in Florida that I got the caladiums that I ordered them from, they say that I should cure them in the sun for about 5 to 7 days, and then I pack them away in rice hulls in cardboard boxes for the winter and keep them indoors in a closet that stays about 50 degrees.
Right. Now, these
and
are...
I've had good luck with them over the years. You know,
right.
I'm up to have about 50 or 60 of them now of all the different colors, and you know, I lose a few every year, but generally speaking, that technique has served me well.
Okay, but we're talking about two different classes of plants.
That's what I thought.
We're
yeah.
talking about summer blooming bulbs, the caladiums, and we're talking about spring bloomers, the hyacinth. And if you think about it, packing away in rice hulls is not that different than the peat moss. If you got a load of rice hulls around, you can store
I keep a ton of them, yeah.
You can store your spring bulbs in the rice hulls. That's just
okay.
as good as the peat moss. But I disagree with laying the plants out in the sun to, quote, cure them on both counts. As far as I'm concerned, that can only expose them to damage. And it's advice I've never heard before.
Huh, I'll be danged.
Well, you probably will, man. You know.
Yeah, most likely, yeah. Well, you know, that has been somewhat of a hassle to do that. So if I can avoid that step, that's fine. I was just afraid of letting the caladiums rot if I didn't dry them out fairly, you know, pretty well first.
Again,
a neat screen box that I've made to dry herbs and bulbs on and keeps the critters out, and I keep it in a shady place outside.
Yeah, but now, see, you're talking about a dehydrator, and you don't want to dehydrate your plants. So, again, if you want to cure them, like I said, inside under a ceiling fan or in a screen porch under a ceiling fan for a couple days, that's great. But then whichever plant it is, packing them away in rice hulls is a great idea, and it seems like you've got a real good system going.
All right. Well, thank you. I will not cure them in the sun anymore. I'll pack them away. That's the easiest way to keep the critters off of them.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, John. Take care.
All right. You have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Patty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Patty. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Patty great?
Since last year, I'm technically called Mill Creek City, which is just a suburb of Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay. So they changed the name of your town?
Well, they, you know, had some big vote where we were part of the county, Salt Lake County, and then they wanted us to be our own city. And so we're called now Mill Creek City.
Oh, my goodness. There was Brexit in Utah?
Yes, there were petitions, and it was on the ballot.
And you had to go to the bank and change in all your euros. I mean, how terrible.
So now I'm my own city.
There you go. All right. Well, we know you're in Utah, so what can we do for Patty in Utah?
So I have a pest problem with my hollyhocks.
Right.
They're a little bug that's gray with a snout. I think it's some type of weevil.
Mm-hmm.
They're harder than an aphid, but they group together kind of like aphids. They kind of are on top of each other, and they kind of put their snout into the bud and pretty much sap the bud so that the flower is either ruined or deformed.
Right.
And the only way I've been controlling it is by hand, by picking them off and sort of squishing them.
Right.
And that works fine for the hollyhock that's close to the house because I can just kind of make it a routine.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a bunch on the back fence that would be kind of a bigger chore to go out there and hand pick them. So I was wondering if there is a method that I could use that's not just with my hands.
Yes. In your part of the country, there is a specific pest called the actual hollyhock weevil. It's well known. They live underground. They live in your plant over the winter. They're mating on your plant right now. The females are laying their eggs inside the flower buds and everything like that. They're a common pest in your part of the country, but they're not considered difficult to control. One of the oldest forms of pest control, something we don't often talk about on the show, but it's the same control for a lot of apple pests here in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic states, is to simply shake the tree or the plant. Get out there and give the whole thing a good shake. And they will all fall off. And then some people will have an old sheet or a blanket underneath, and then they'll roll it up real fast and they'll stomp all over it or something. Or people will have buckets with a little bit of soapy water in the bottom so that most of the weevils fall into that. But oddly enough, just shaking them out of the plant kills quite a few of them. It disorients them, makes them want to live in a different hollyhock. That is absolutely your best control. One of the other things that comes to mind would be a clay spray like Surround, which you would spray on your plant early in the season to protect it. But the clay imparts a white color to the plant. You don't want that. You want to see this hibiscus in its full form with the green leaves and the fabulous flowers.
Right.
So you don't want anything that looks like that. And in Utah, in the summertime, I would never advise using any kind of insecticidal soap or insecticidal oil because it just gets too hot where you are, right?
Oh, like Tuesday, we're going to have 100 degrees.
Yeah. So the first thing I would do is shake the tree. And you can either do something to collect them underneath or just keep shaking the tree. Your other option is to get a high-powered water hose, like a garden hose that has good pressure or a pressure washer, and shoot the little buggers out of the hollyhock. Now, you know you're going to blow off a lot of the flowers, at the same time. But these sharp streams of water will kill almost all of the weevils in your plant, and you know how quickly these plants regrow new flowers.
Right. So how often should I shake it?
Well, I would shake it every day, especially if I was really ticked off at these things.
Okay.
And like I said, the hosing down, which I would do in the morning, first thing in the morning. Don't do that in the heat of the day or in the evening. It could stress the plant. But first thing in the morning, blasting the rats out of the hollyhocks would be really personally satisfying and good for the plant in the long run.
Okay. So that's easy. I can do that.
Yes. Most gardening solutions are a lot easier than people think.
But much easier than hand picking one at a time.
Oh, yeah. that gets old real fast.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck, Patty.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who planted garlic last fall that depending on your locale, harvest time is fast approaching. So pull up a sample plant when the bottom third of each of your plants has turned brown. If the sample looks good, pull it all. Just don't harvest too early, don't wait too long, and don't go looking for all the details under the letter G for garlic at the A to Z Garden Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with slugs, clips, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the questions of the week. It's a doubleheader. We're going to tell you how to get rid of slimy slugs and the only sensible thing to do with your grass clippings. It's coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Charles, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing?
I'm doing just ducky today, Charles. How are you, sir?
Not bad at all.
So where is Charles not bad?
I'm in Ocean View, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. And do you have an ocean view?
No, I don't. I have a Garden State Parkway view.
What exit?
17.
All right. What can we do for Charles in New Jersey?
I have this gorgeous 15 to 18-year-old maple tree in front of my house. I took pictures of it, and went to the state center. They told me I have a yellow belly sapsuckers attacking it.
Right. So that's very distinctive damage. It's all these little holes, generally in a ring around the tree,
yeah.
And there's lots of them.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so the sapsucker...
Nobody can tell me what I can do for my tree or to keep the bird away, you know.
That's why you called me.
Right.
Okay. So the yellow-bellied sapsucker is the name of a very common woodpecker here in the Northeast. It does have a yellow belly, and it does suck sap. And if you think about maple trees, and you were a sap-sucking woodpecker, you'd be looking for maples all the time because that's where maple syrup comes from.
Yeah, I can understand it.
They're getting the treat of their life. And they are helpful birds in other ways, but they can really go after a maple that is delivering a lot of sap to them, and they can do a lot of damage. Now, are the holes on one side of the tree, or have they ringed it around?
No, they're in a ring all the way around, and they're up 5 to 6 foot apart, the rings, about 12 to 15 feet up the tree.
Oh, so they're really doing a job on you, man.
So there's basically about 9 rings as you go up the tree.
Okay. So typically the trees can survive the damage, but it seems like you're getting a lot of attack. So I want you to do a couple of different things. One way to attract woodpeckers to your garden and home in the wintertime is to put out suet feeders. Because, again, these are carnivores. These are birds that eat a lot of bugs, too. So they're good to have around. Now, normally you have to take down suet feeders in the summertime because the suet gets all gooey. But you can go to a good garden center and you can buy suet that is made specifically to be good in the summertime. So the first thing I want you to do is get a bunch of the little cages that hold the suet cakes. Get some of these suet cakes that are good for the summertime that don't get all runny. And hang them not on the tree, but in every area near the tree. That'll get the birds away. And then, I want you to wrap the tree. I'm trying to think of what the best wrap is going to be. Hardware cloth, they're going to be able to get their beaks through it. You don't really want to cover the bark with anything really solid, but you got
the only thing I found online that they said use a hardware cloth. Well, then when I went back online to see what hardware cloth actually is, it's almost like chicken wire, and I'm saying, well, the birds want to go right through that, you know.
Yes, I agree with you. Hardware cloth comes to mind, but they can get their beaks right through the holes in the hardware cloth. So I'm thinking temporarily for the summer, I would, if you can do it, if you can get at least as much of the tree as you can cover, I would wrap it in a single piece of cardboard stapled or taped together at the end and cover as much of the bark as you can. It's not the ideal situation, but it'll break their habit of doing it now. So I'm thinking they're not going to like the feeling of the cardboard, and you don't have to go out and buy cardboard. Everybody's got tons of it from all the boxes from Amazon coming to our house. So just, you know, wrap single pieces of cardboard around it. I think that's going to do the least damage to the tree. It'll keep the creatures off. There's also another product I'd like you to pick up. It's called Bird Scare Flash Tape. And it's a little roll of tape that looks like, if you remember the old reel-to-reel tape recorders?
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's that kind of a tape, but it's Mylar. It shines in the light. It keeps reflecting different things. With the least little breeze, it cracks and whistles. It's been found to be a good bird deterrent, and it's really inexpensive. It's called Bird Scare Flash Tape, and you would buy a roll of that, and you would just hang sections of it from the tree. That would scare the birds as they're approaching, and then the tree would be protected. Your final solution, if it's somewhere near your home, you can get a motion-activated sprinkler and point it at the tree. So every time a bird lands on the tree, the motion-activated sprinkler would come on and shoo them off with a burst of cold water. So you got a lot of options, but I think start with the suet feeders to give them an alternative form of food. And again, motion-activated sprinkler will keep them off as well, and you'll find that that's great for keeping deer out of your garden and all sorts of things.
Yeah, well, this is close to my house. I could do the tape, the sprinkler, and the show it.
There you go. All right, you're all set, Charles.
Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir.
Okay.
1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Nice to chat with you.
Oh, nice.
I am calling from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Excellent, excellent. And are you a gem?
Yes. I'm a gem. J-E-N, Jen.
Oh, Jen, not gem. Okay.
Well, it depends on who you ask, I guess.
All right. What can we do for Jen or Jem from Cape Cod?
Well, my husband and I have completely revamped our yard. We're pretty much at the point now where we have like small areas of grass, but mostly in favor of dandelions and creeping thyme and clover and all kinds of other wonderful plants that are not grass.
Right, right, right.
The problem that we're having, we had a drought this past summer, and I don't know if that had something to do with it, but a lot of our creeping thyme, probably about July, started to die. And we have it scattered, so it's in areas where some is full sun, some is part sun.
So you've got creeping thyme, and it's scattered throughout areas of sun and shade. It did well for 3 years and seemed to die out last summer when you're sure you had a drought, right?
Yes, we definitely did have a drought.
Okay. Is the death of thyme worse in sunny or shady areas, or is it about equal?
I would say the sunnier is worse.
Okay. So then I think perhaps your diagnosis is correct. Thyme is a very sturdy, hardy plant, but any plant can be subject to drought. And obviously, although maybe not obviously to some people, the worst effects are going to be in full sun, whereby the plants in shade are more protected, and plants in shade use much less water than plants full sun. Now, creeping thyme is very hardy, and it's just about time for it to show if it's really most sincerely dead. Are you willing to wait a little bit and see if it greens up again?
Yes. I mean, that's the goal, because we have so much of it at this point. I loved it. I just fell in love with it and kept adding to areas. And like I said, in favor of clover and creeping thyme and over grass.
Right. And so you have some areas of creeping thyme that are doing very well.
Yes, a couple areas that are sort of more shady, to your point. Yes.
Understood. So you got two options here. The first option is we wait, and when the healthy plants are greening up, and we see what the other plants are doing. If they're not greening up, you have two options. One, the springtime, just as these plants are regrowing again, coming out of dormancy, that's the best time to divide existing plants. So you could take some of your lively thyme, and if there's if it's truly dead, you could replace the dead areas with plugs, you know, just root cuttings. You'd cut a big plant in half and move it, roots and all, over to replace the dead plant. Although, if you are totally correct, and this sunny area is always going to demand that you water during times of drought, and you're not interested in doing that, then keep the thyme where it's flourishing and take a look at the drought-resistant native plants of Wisconsin and perhaps replace the thyme with something completely different that I think would fit in with what I'm hearing from you. Is you don't want a lawn and you want a no-work kind of pollinator-attracting, bee-friendly garden.
Pollinator.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
So that's it. You can try transplanting it, but I think maybe it's telling you that those other areas are not the spot for thyme, but for another plant.
Yes. Yep, they definitely let us know, that's for sure.
The plants
it might take a year or two, but they do.
The plants are very good at talking to us. We're not so good at listening sometimes.
Absolutely.
All right. All right. Well, good luck, Jen.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the questions of the week. Yes, it's a special summertime doubleheader. Controlling slugs and using grass clippings wisely. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started.
Two different questions this week? What's up?
Well, two different reasons. It's clear from my emails that lots of new people are coming on board who haven't heard a lot of the basics, especially concerning things we haven't mentioned on the show in a while. And there are some topics, like these two, that we really should cover every season at the right time of year, no matter what. So let us bask in some double-down basics.
Beginning with Evan in Philadelphia, who writes, "My wife and I have always composted our lawn clippings, but recently moved and our new backyard backs up to a golf course with a creek and about 5 yards of wooded area in between. The previous owner says that the lawn is untreated, but the golf course obviously treats their turf heavily. Will we be able to continue to compost our clippings despite the potential for runoff and cross-contamination?"
Well, first, I'd worry a lot more about my water supply. If you're on a well, get that water tested ASAP, as agricultural chemicals can travel great distances underground. And I hope that the golf course exercises caution near that creek. Herbicides and chemical fertilizers can wreak havoc in those kind of aquatic areas.
And no matter where you live, don't compost your grass clippings.
Because those clippings are 10% nitrogen by weight, and that is the absolute perfect food and the perfect percentage for lawn grasses. Removing the clippings after you mow literally starves your lawn of its most natural food. If you have a good quality mower with a sharp blade, you won't ever see any of the pulverized clippings, but your lawn will get a free, gentle, supplemental feeding every time you mow.
And people tend to overload their compost piles with nitrogen-rich green materials like grass clippings at this time of year, which can lead to a stinky mess.
Right, but even if you did save large amounts of shredded leaves back in the fall to balance out those greens, you should still be leaving the clippings on the lawn. It's good for the grass, and come on, it is much less work for you.
And can I just add that you should never, ever try to compost grass clippings alone, and never, ever, ever try and compost clippings from a lawn that has been treated with herbicides, because the resulting compost can kill any plants that aren't grass?
No, we don't have the time. What's the next question?
Deanna in Eastern Montgomery County near Philadelphia writes, "Do you have any expert advice on how to control slugs? They have eaten the beans I planted, killed my flowers, and are now on my basil leaves. I put a pie plate of salt water out, but fear the problem will just get worse through the summer as the veggies grow. Is there any commercial product I should be using around the garden?"
Well, I'll shock everybody by changing tactics and directly answer that last part of the question with a simple yes. Non-toxic slug control pellets sold under brand names like Sluggo and Escargo attract the nasty slimers with a yeasty bait. That yeast is highly attractive to slugs. But the pellets also contain iron phosphate, which the slugs can't metabolize. Although deadly to slugs and snails, iron phosphate is harmless to people, pets, earthworms, and more importantly, frogs and toads.
Because toads eat slugs, and lots of them. Partially because both creatures are active at night.
And because both like to live in the same kind of moist, shady environments. And it's easy to get slug-eaten toads to live in your garden. Two things you need to do. Number one, do not use chemical pesticides.
Very important, because amphibians like toads have porous skin that makes them very susceptible to pesticide poisoning.
No perhaps about it. Now, the other thing they need is a toad abode, a damp, shady spot to hide out in during the day. The ideal abode is something like a big board propped up on bricks in a heavily vegetated area of the garden, like under some big hostas or huge shrubs. Put some old carpeting, dirt, or mulch on top of the board to keep it moist and cool inside the abode.
Speaking of mulch, you should consider raking away any heavy mulches until you get your slugs under control. Heavy mulch provides a perfect hiding place for slugs in the daytime.
And you can also lay boards down around the affected plants. When the sun comes up, go out with a 5-gallon bucket with a little bit of soapy water in the bottom. Lift up the boards and scrape all the slugs hiding on the underside into the soapy water. Very satisfying. As is installing copper barriers on your raised bed frames or around the tops of your containers. Or putting out small containers of fresh beer, not stale beer, in the garden at sunset and finding them full of dead drunken slugs in the morning.
But her salt water?
Like Rick in Casablanca, she has been misinformed. If you go out at night and sprinkle just the tiniest bit of regular salt onto a slug, it will quickly shrivel up and die. But alas, they will not hurl themselves into a miniature ocean for you. Well, that sure was some interesting information about slugs and grass clippings now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over with links to more detailed articles about both topics, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to unsalt my slugs if I don't get out of the studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location if you want us to read that email. And or visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live. But where you will probably find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to email us about, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website slime-free. The well-clipped Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It appears that our editor, Al Banks, has drank the beer. And hey, where's associate producer Brett Rader? There's an empty six-pack. I'm bone-dry Mike McGrath, and I guess I'll just iron out my personal slug problems so I can see you again next week. Most people think that wild strawberry only refers to a vining plant with a tasteless little round fruit. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a look at a wild strawberry that's worth the eating. Plus your fabulous phone calls.